Hello there, and welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is author Noel O'Regan, whose debut novel, Though the Bodies Fall, is out now with Granta Books. Just kind of want to go back to the beginning and, you know, when you grew up, not when you grew up, obviously you grew up when you were small, but, you know, what kind of a reader you were as a child, if you were a reader, and what you were like as a little boy.
Yeah, it's funny. I wasn't the biggest reader. I think it's okay for me to admit that now. It's like my family are sports fanatics, I guess is the best way of putting it. And so if there's a language in my house, it's out of sport. It's football, rugby, basically anything that's on. We'll be talking about it. And so, yeah, in my early years, it was, you know, I wanted to be the next Morris Fitzgerald. I wanted to be the next Roy Keane, the next Tiger Woods, the next, like, Roger Federer. So reading was there and I enjoyed it, but it was very much secondary to sport and all that. But when I was reading, it was a lot of, you know, I'm a long time listener to this podcast. So I think every author you've had on has talked about Roald Dahl, but it's, you can't escape him as a child. Nor would you want to, I should stress, like there is something magical to his work. And I definitely went through that phase of being obsessed with all his stories. Although funnily enough, I think maybe the strongest memory for me of his work is actually the movie adaptation of The Witches. Like when I think back, I think like it scared the crap out of me.
Yeah. it's
Angelica Houston and like that scene where she peels off her face like to the other witches and I still get goosebumps thinking about it.
It's almost too, yeah. Sorry, go on.
No, she was just so brilliant in that role, you know, terrifying.
It is, but it's still terrifying as an adult. I hadn't seen it. I put it on for my youngest at the time, and we had to pause it. It was actually it was actually genuinely too chilling for them at the time. And I could totally see why. It's absolutely horrifying.
I'm pretty sure I had nightmares. Like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I had nightmares from it.
But I think Roald Dahl, I don't know. I was one of those people that didn't read him as a child. I know pretty much everybody else did. I was the Hans Christian Andersen sort of little girl. But I did come to them later with my own children and I found them really disturbing. Yeah.
Have you read his more adult short stories at all?
No, I don't. Well, maybe I have. Like, for example.
Yeah, like it. Talking about disturbing, like they could be quite disturbing, so it's taken to a whole other level. Wes Anderson recently adapted some of them actually for Netflix into short films, which I'd highly recommend.
Oh, which one? No, this isn't the one I'm thinking of, like a triptych of Wes Anderson. You know, the little shorts, maybe it wasn't even Wes Anderson.
There's three of them,
and one of them is like a drowning house in the middle. And oh my god, there's three little short films. Maybe it's not Wes Anderson.
It is Wes, and he adapts some of Roald Dahl's more adult short stories, they're weird. the children stories are weird, but these are another level. I would argue, in mostly in a good way, in an interesting way.
Yeah, I'm all for weird in the good way. I don't know. Yeah, Roald Dahl. I'm sort of not that anyone cares, but I think he's done all right for himself.
Like I do.
So anyway, Roald Dahl was definitely in your subconscious then as a little boy.
Definitely, and the Narnia series. I have a memory of. I wonder if this is a false memory, but I have a memory of them coming in Kellogg's cereal boxes for a time when I was a child. So, like I remember collecting them, the different that entire Narnia series, like whether it was Kellogg's or
figurines.
No, it was actually the books. It was like really slim volumes. Now maybe you had to send away for them. I can't quite remember, but I remember like being really excited about those. My aunt, Ina, a lovely warm woman she's passed away since, unfortunately, but she gave me a copy of Kidnapped by Robert Louis Stevenson, which I absolutely loved as well.
Remind me of the story of that, because I was looking at my notes and I thought, yeah, then I was getting confused with Treasure Island, and I was getting confused with like Robinson Crusoe, is a completely different author in a different century. But yeah, remind us of Kidnapped.
Yeah, it was like set in the 1800s, I think, during like the Jacobite War. And the main character, I think he's 17, something like that, David Balfour, his parents pass away, and he's sent to his uncle at this estate up in Scotland. And I think it turns out that David is the rightful heir to the estate. So the uncle basically tries to kill him. And when that fails, he has him kidnapped. And I think he tries to send him to the Carolinas or something like that to be a slave, basically. And it's much hijinks and adventure.
So ensues, yeah, you say adventure. Were you that kind of like kid? Was it adventure novels? Was it kind of action? Was it?
It very much was
that kind of thing.
Yeah. At that point, definitely thrillers. Like of a memory, I was home at Christmas, and I know it's somewhere in the house, but there was a book I obsessively took out of the library in my primary school. It's called Hunted. And it was kind of a World War II era thriller, basically, of this man and child trying to escape the Gestapo to get to Switzerland. And I couldn't find it at home because I can't remember who wrote it. I can't remember the author. And it's quite a generic thriller, but at the time I just loved it, and I kept taking it out. And I think in the end I made my parents buy me a copy just to have it at home. And so yeah, when I was reading it, yeah, they tended to be adventures, they tended to be kind of thrillers, things like that.
You know, you were saying, oh, you weren't much of a reader as a little boy, and yet it sounds like you know, yeah, you really were. Like, I mean, of course, maybe sport was like your main thing, but
yeah, I guess it wasn't an obsession yet in right. the way that it would become, I suppose. Like, sport was my obsession.
Is sport still your obsession? Is that still as prevalent in your life now as it was then? Or did it sort of, was it subsumed by anything?
Yeah, well, I certainly don't play. I don't play as much. But I would still obviously follow Kerry. I wouldn't be allowed back in the county if I didn't follow the footballers.
Yeah, because I know, well, just because it's there in your book, you know, so strongly. Well, not as a major thing, but it weaves in and out.
It is there, and like, you know, you don't see a lot of that in literary fiction. I feel you don't see a lot of sport, and I like the idea of kind of weaving it in, as you say, a little bit. And I guess it speaks to my own life and my own.
Sure.
Upbringing. I still follow, but like not as obsessively. You know, I don't get depressed if Man United lose a game anymore. Happens a lot more often now, of course.
This is where I pretend to understand sports references once they get more specific. I'll laugh along with names that I am unfamiliar with and won't get the, you know, any irony, anything like that. So just warning you now. My sports knowledge, I think you've mentioned literally every sports person I've ever heard of at the very start. So that's it. That's me.
They're the main ones.
They're the main ones. Yeah, there's only about four or five, so we're grand. yeah, I was just thinking as you were growing up, so I can sort of see this little boy and like you grow up in Kerry and all of these different influences. And so what was there a divide between sport and reading? Did you carry on with both? And what kind of reader did you turn into as you kind of turned into a teenager and a young adult and kind of went through school?
Yeah, there was a clear kind of turning point for me, which was a holiday I took with my parents to France when I was either 13 or 14. And it was my first time abroad with my parents and kind of first time away from like my friends and, you know, playing football and my N64 at the time, I think. So I was away from all my usual kind of things. And I had brought some books with me, thrillers, and I read them. I was bored out of my mind. So I just started reading and something switched, something flicked in me. And I remember reading, I brought like two or three books with me, read them in 2 days maybe. And then I stole my mom's books, read those, stole my dad's books, read those. And I just it was like a light had come on. And it wasn't even just like as a reader, but I remember coming back from that holiday being like, well, this is what I want to do. Like, you know, I don't want to play for Man United or Gary. It's like, I want to be a writer. This is amazing. How do you even go about doing this? And
that was quite something to have all of it. You know, not only did you just kind of discover books, but you decided, right, okay, now I'm going to do this.
Well, with the a high degree of naivety and ignorance, I would say. I remember literally like a couple of weeks later coming back and writing my first short story and being like, oh yeah, this is easy.
Oh yeah, following in a great tradition of writers who you know, teenage kind of precociousness. I was just thinking
it was terrible. Like, I mean, it was a terrible story. I just didn't know, but it was so exciting to be able to just write stuff and all that.
And you didn't hit when you were in France. You didn't hit that kind of you weren't in a sort of a melancholia. You know, there wasn't that kind of bonjour tristesse. You know, you're sitting by the pool watching the sparrows. Kind of, you know. You didn't have a kind of existential, it wasn't like an ennui thing when you came back, it was more of an excitement.
Yeah, it's giving too much depth to it. Like, I'm not that cool, unfortunately. It was just sheer boredom. It was like, I can't play the computer, I can't play soccer, I'm just going to read, and just whatever it was, it just flicked.
You kind of had a total immersion.
Yeah. Mm. And like, I remember coming back then and it was like, well, okay, I need to read widely, I need to read like whatever I can. I forget who told me to take it out of the library, but I took out Raymond Carver's Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? His first collection, where he's at his most kind of minimalist, Carver-esque, or, well, in hindsight, his most Gordon Lish-ish, we could say. But I remember reading, again, that same naivety and reading that, because it was so simple and so pared back. I'm like, I can do this.
Yeah, of course.
No problem. Yeah. Not realizing just how incredibly difficult it is to write something so deceptively simple.
Yeah, but what a brilliant, brilliant thing to read at that age, though. That's
And I remember reading Steinbeck and people like that, and like, not getting it like fully, but at least I was like, okay, I'm reading it. And I remember I went through a big fantasy phase at that point as well. Like, you know, I was still reading other stuff. I was obsessed with like The Wheel of Time, Robert Jordan series, which was coming out around that time. It's hilarious. Like, if you told me then it would take me, you know, 20 years to publish a book, I probably would have gone back to trying to play for Kerry, but
and 20 years, I didn't know. 20 years is probably quite normal, isn't it? If you think about it. You know, it's not about normal in heavy quotation marks, are like, what's normal about the writing life? But you know,
what's normal is that there are always peaks and troughs, you know. Mm. There are always ups and downs.
Do you think you need to get sort of beaten about a bit by life anyway, you know, bruised, broken, bashed about before you can really get anything decent out?
100%. Yeah. You need to show, like, what do you know at that age, or even like in your 20s, like, it's, you're still learning so much to be a reader, to be a writer, and just to be a bloody person, you know.
Yeah.
It's
like that bashed up rabbit, isn't it? Whatever, I can't remember the quote, you know, your ears fall off and your tail falls off and you're bashed about and your fur is ragged, and but you know, that's how you know you're real.
I've definitely been there, so yeah.
I was wondering, because you said, okay, so you had this, I mean, sometimes it's hard when we look back to really, because you sort of put your own narrative on your own narrative, you know what I mean? So it's hard to remember what you really, really felt at 14 and whether you really, I mean, did you, you know, okay, so we're seeing this kind of some sort of an epiphany about it. I want to write. But you went on to college to study. Did you go on to college to study creative writing, or was it English, or was it what, or humanities, or what was your?
Yeah, it was an arts degree in UCC. But I did end up doing a single honours degree in English with a kind of side of philosophy. And it was like, okay, well, how do I become a writer? How do I best, like, learn my trade?
And did you? Do you think it served you that way?
Yes and no. I mean, you're always distracted from these things. But probably the best thing for me during those years was actually a certain Claire Keegan became writer in residence at UCC while I was there. And she was there for, I think, 3 terms. And so I had pretty much weekly workshops with her for like 1.5 years. At such a crucial juncture. And it was really, like, I learned so much during that time from her, from the group. She was honestly, like, I think the first writer I'd met in person, you know, like it was still this exalted, distant thing. So to have someone there who had a book and had very strong, clear ideas on what writing was and what good writing was invaluable, you know. And even just to be with other aspiring writers as well in those workshops and to be hanging around with people who wanted the same thing. And
there'll be so many people listening to this who just be green with envy, including me, that Claire Keegan
it's very lucky. I mean, she'll admit herself, like, they were tough, those workshops, you know. Like, she is definitely not easy on your writing, but what you realize very quickly is that, like, she's bringing the same kind of intensity of vision to your work that she would bring to her own. So she's giving you the gift of seeing where you have to get to, kind of, like, which is it's tough in the moment, but, like, you take it in and you persevere.
So she's a gifted educator then as well.
Yeah, I would say so, definitely. I know some other writers who've been through that as well, and it does improve you, it does shape you.
So was there, that's a person, I suppose, as well as a writer who shaped you maybe a little bit as you grew. Has there been a book in particular, a novel or whatever, that has maybe opened up something to you? As a writer, perhaps, or as a reader, or as a person, is there a book that has kind of taught you something, or that you kind of value that way?
Yeah. I would say maybe McGahern's That They May Face the Rising Sun is a book I return to a lot. And, like, McGahern's writing generally, which I would have come to through Claire, actually, back in the day. I mean, I was almost allergic to Irish literature for a lot of, like, my secondary school years. I don't know if it's just the way it's taught in school or what it is, or maybe it just feels too close to home. But it was kind of in college that I fell in love with Irish literature, I guess, as well, and with writers like McGahern. And there's something, I don't know, I do keep returning to his work. And I think I was reading a book recently about the Irish short story. I forget, it's a history of the Irish short story by, it's Ingman.
That rings a bell.
Yeah, and they talked about kind of Joyce and McGahern, writers of that ilk, and Claire Keegan as well. How there's an almost a sacramental quality to the writing, like a sense of grace or something, as if, you know, as if the author's, like, abandoned Catholicism has, like, found its way into the writer's kind of way of seeing. And I think there's something, a lot of the writers I return to have that. It's almost like a sacramental realism or something. I think Marilyn Robinson as well would be that, even though, of course, she still has her faith. But I think when you talk about religious writing, it's more about, like, bringing a sense of compassion and, I think, perceptiveness. Mm-hmm. Maybe, again, it's comes back to that way of seeing rather than any literal fate. So they've shaped me definitely in a big way. I would say maybe Tim Robinson as well. His Connemara trilogy. Like, I love writers of place, and I don't know if there's a better writer of place than Tim Robinson, to be honest.
Well, what about yourself as a writer, when you talk there about this kind of, I know exactly, well, exactly, I don't know exactly what you're talking about, but I can sense what you're getting at.
Yeah, it's hard to articulate.
Yeah, with that sense, that kind of, yeah, sacramental is a great word actually for it. But you know, is it something that you kind of reach for in your own work? Are you trying to, you know, I felt that I read Though the Bodies Fall before Christmas, sometime before Christmas, and I feel that reaching for that sense of, yeah, you know, there is, you're obviously going to tell the listeners a little bit about the book in a moment, but just talking about your actual, the writing and the kind of the sense of the real and the abstract, what you're talking about, this way of seeing that, trying to just get this again. I said, oh, it's impossible to talk about, isn't it? It's like trying to talk about, you're trying to talk about a painting or something. And it's like, I'm sure people will pick this book up afterwards and maybe understand what I'm getting to. Do you feel put it this way, or do you feel like you're at the start of the road with that? Do you feel you're somewhere in the middle? Do you feel you're getting close? Do you feel that you'll never get there? Or is it just the joy is just in the process?
Well, firstly, the joy is in the process, and you have to kind of believe that and stick to that. Is it something I'm kind of striving for in my own writing? I think it probably is. But I think also that the more you kind of try and reach for it, maybe the harder it is to attain. So if it comes true in the writing, there has to be almost an effortlessness to it, maybe. But then I'll contradict myself and say that I probably am trying to reach towards that in my writing.
You were mentioning landscape there as well, and you know, the novel's obviously, and I'm saying obviously again for anyone listening, you know, it's set, I mean, there's a cliff top, we're in Kerry, we're on the west coast, it's stark and beautiful, and it's an isolated house, so there's this sense of, I mean, landscape is, you know, like a lot of maybe European writers, the 1900s, it's a very strong presence. It's an entity in itself. Is that something that you set out to do?
Yeah, very much. I'm very interested in the idea of kind of environmental determinism, in the sense of how we're kind of shaped by our surroundings, and how we connect or fail to connect to kind of the natural world around us. And so with Though the Bodies Fall, with that book, there's a sense of kind of digging into the meanings we kind of put upon certain places and what it means to kind of grow up in a place where there is such a strong meaning attached to it, and how that does shape the characters in the story. I've loved landscape writing. I've loved nature writing for so long. And it's also what interests me in kind of creatively. So I'm always trying to write into that and write into ideas of kind of home and belonging as well, a little bit.
Because the book is quite, I mean, obviously there's some dark themes in it, but I find it so, I mean, there were some lovely flashes of nature with little clumps of wildflowers, or just rain in itself being almost just like an old friend, you know, and it was very, I thought, very sensory book to just, you felt you were kind of absorbed in the weather, do you want to just tell everybody a little bit about the book first, because I'm going to keep talking about it and they're going to go,
it follows Micheál Burns, who lives alone on his family's land at the end of a headland in Kerry. And there are cliffs there that have been a draw for people who are struggling for generations. And so Micheál, like his parents before him, is trying to help the people that come to the cliffs, the visitors, as they refer to them, even as his sisters, Áine and Saoirse, are now looking to sell the land to be rid of it once and for all. That's kind of the synopsis.
I can tell you've said that one or two times. You have had the glazed look, you know, when people say, so where did you get the idea for this book? And go, well,
I tell you, I have prepped that quite a bit, but it's just because it can be so difficult to talk about your work. You know, it's one thing to write the bloody thing is, it's a completely different skill to then have to, like, oh, to talk about it. And I have no confidence whatsoever in it. So
it's a horrible question, though. So what's your book about, or tell us about it? Because again, it's like, you just read it. But having said that, it is such a great concept. Like, when I was first introduced to it, I was like, oh, why did I think of that? It's brilliant. It's so good because it's so simple. And yet you make it into such, you know, you go right into it, swim around in it. But it's so hard. Like, do you know what you said earlier on, the word effortless? It feels effortless. And yet, of course, I know that it isn't. But it's such a simple idea. And yet, God, yeah, really.
Yeah, I was like, I guess I was hoping to write something that felt timely but also timeless in a way, kind of like prescient but also maybe even a little old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. But kind of something that defamiliarizes that tradition as well.
Yeah, there was, what is the expression you use? I was trying to think of it this morning and I can't remember. It's something to do with the washing up, or I don't know, maybe you can. There was just an expression. I thought, is that a Kerry expression, or is this a different way that you're just writing about it that kind of takes the familiar out of the familiar? You know, it's kind of like, oh, it's a familiar thing, said in a slightly askew way, but it becomes part of the whole thing and it repeats a few times. And like, oh, there's a thing again. And it's like, I don't know, maybe it is just a Kerryism. And I'm like, you can't put your finger on it, can you? It's like,
Was it a phrase? Was that true?
Something, I think it was like that, like to do the washing up or to clean the plates or to, it was definitely, it was some kind of domestic thing.
I'm drawing a blank now, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I couldn't remember this morning either, but I remember clocking it and just kind of going, oh, that's, in a kind of
I did
a
try
nice
and
way.
Throw in as many Kerryisms as possible. So
yeah, that's what it might have just been. It might have just been, you'd be like, "That's you're not remembering it because it's so usual for you, maybe." But that whole idea about like making the art, like it really does feel like there's the village shop, there's the cycle there, there's this kind of familiarity, mm-hmm. but it is quite not abstract in that sense. Like obviously, all the things are real, but it is like that kind of world building in a sense. It could be anywhere, anytime, any place.
Yeah, that was the aim. Like, it's funny because I did also want it to have that specificity too, because like it was in part a love letter to like that part of Kerry, which is where I grew up and that I do know so well and love and haven't really seen too much in literature. So even just the idea of naming these places and putting them on the page was kind of a thrill. And getting to show it in all its beauty, but also kind of dig beneath the postcard beauty of the place as well and not be afraid to show the darkness that's there, that's everywhere, that's in the air of every, you know, stretch of coast, really.
Is this where I can say in a movie voice, and also the darkness inside us?
That's it, yeah. I'll get you to do the movie trailer if it ever happens.
But, you know, joking aside, it does, you know, it does explore impulses, dark impulses, and self-loathing, and you know, how we are formed by our upbringing, all that kind of stuff. But but it's also quite, I mean, it's so gripping as well. So you have such a great kind of
I hope, like, it is dark as you say, but like I hope there's some kind of empathy and warmth and humanity coming through as well, because I think when people hear the plot, sometimes there might be an assumption that it is
that it's going to be
incredibly bleak, you know.
No, and it's not.
But I did try and push against that a bit as well.
It's really not at all. And you know, Sammy the dog. You know, any book that has a dog in it for me is like, you know, it's already winning there. So Sammy,
I have been told multiple times how Sammy steals the show.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm proud of that.
So I don't know, we're just going to ask you some of the sort of silly, superficial questions before I ask you to read from the book, because sometimes I skip these and I'm like, well, you know, I found out what, and this is a horrible question because people don't like to leave books in there to burn. And I don't know if you have one or if you've thought about it yet, if there's a book, either you can choose here. I'm going to give you a choice here because it'll make it easier for you. You can either choose something to leave in the house to burn that you wrote, so it can be published, unpublished, doesn't matter. You can leave something to burn in the house that you wrote, or you can leave someone else. I think I'm making it so personal. Mm. Someone else's book, but maybe a book that you wouldn't rush in to pull out of the burning house.
Yeah. Well, if it were to be one of my own, there is an initial attempt at writing a novel when I was about 16, 17, that I finished, to be fair, and I'm proud, and it was a necessary step along the way. But I found a hard copy of it recently.
I was going to say, you still have it?
I think I had them on floppy disks, long ago. But I found a hard copy that I'd obviously printed off. And I'd say it must be 80, 90,000 words. It's book length, coherent story. I termed it a philosophical thriller. Yeah. And it's as bad, it's as terrible as it sounds.
I can't ask. Have you viewed any funny, not funny, but if you had any quotes from it, you know?
I don't have it to hand, I'm afraid. I was laughing. I showed it to my partner as well, and she got a good laugh out of it.
But it's still amazing that you managed to write an entire novel at that age. But like you say, with the coherence, structure and everything else, brilliant.
It honestly was. And it was a huge step on the journey. And again, it showed that I could do it. And it's where I was at that time as well. And it's kind of, I shouldn't laugh at it because it was a necessary step, but it's pretty terrible. Really and look, it's important to laugh at ourselves as well.
I know, but I remember I found something of mine from when I was around that age, and I have the opening line of something is, I don't want to be embarrassing to say this now publicly, but it was art, a small noun, a huge concept.
Well, it's true.
So funny. Clearly you must have thought, this is
profound.
Really good.
Yeah, no, my book reeked of profundity.
I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to let you leave that in there to burn. That sounds too.
Oh, please, please let me. Please.
Maybe we'll let. No, I don't know. And the other one then is, aside from any pets, dogs, cats, animals, goldfish, people, is there anything that isn't a book that you would save from your burning house?
This is probably a cheat because I would say my laptop, but that's purely because of the new material I'm working on, or being afraid that I would have forgotten to put something onto the cloud,
yeah,
something like that.
You just mentioned what you're working on, so have you got over the kind of, are you onto something, are you onto the difficult second album or third album?
I am indeed, yeah. It's funny because I finished Though the Bodies Fall 2 years ago now. I mean, there were some edits with Grant, of course, but pretty much since then I have been working on, there were a few things I was working on because there were three ideas I had I was kind of equally excited about, but also equally unsure if they were feasible. So I kind of dug into each of them.
Right.
And I'm down to the one now that I feel is the best bet, if that makes sense.
It does.
Certainly as book two. And I'm hoping I'll get it done this year, but again, you just don't know. You just don't know. That I have other shelved novels, let's call them, rather than failed in the background.
Shelved is a good one to use. Yeah. But do you find it hard to talk about the first novel now because you're kind of so involved in the new thing?
It's weird because even there, when you ask me if I remember that quote, I'm like, no, my mind's blank because my head is full with the new one, and even having to talk about some themes and things like that, it does take me a moment to step back into it, and I have to look over some of my notes and stuff.
What actually happened?
Exactly, yeah. But it speaks to publishing now that there is such a quite a long turnaround. There were 18 months between signing and publication with my first book. So
that's it. Someone said there are two speeds. It's either glacier or all of a sudden. So it kind of.
Yeah. And from what I'm hearing, it's only getting longer, actually. So. Yeah.
And do you have, or I suppose we're not allowed to know anything yet about the new thing. You don't have a working title. You can't give us any little clues.
You know what? I have this weird thing where I've learned not to talk about it.
Yeah.
Works in progress, because in my head it works and it's going to be brilliant. But if I start talking about it, the whole thing will fall apart.
You smother it. I know, like, it extinguishes it as soon as you say, oh, I think the themes are about this. And it just kind of goes,
yeah. It's like, okay. Are they though?
I know. This is shit.
That as original as I think.
Yeah, I know. No, it's much better just to keep it secret. That was bad of me to ask. I just sometimes want.
No, that is all.
But anyway, good luck with that. So you're hopefully going to get a decent draft of that this year and see
what
that
is. That's the hope.
Okay. Well, we're going to go back to the first book, even though that was years ago and you can't remember what happened. So I'm only joking. And you're going to read a little bit for us. So I think, have we told everybody? We've told everybody generally about the setting and the concept and everything else. So you can just take it from there and tell us where you're reading from. And
Sure. I'm reading a scene set at Christmas, and Michal is kind of staring out across the bay and thinking about Christmas's past. So I think I've given all the information. And Saoirse and Anya is the sisters, and Sammy is the dog. So Michal sits on the windowsill, looks across the bay. It is a clear day, crisp. The peninsula opposite shades of deep blue and heather brown. Almost directly south on the far peninsula is the site of another Christmas tradition, one that marked every year of his childhood. After early mass, his mother would drive the four of them to the graveyard in Tralee, lay wreaths at the graves of his grandparents, his father. Rather than return home, she then drove through town, past the windmill of Blennerville and out the Dingle Peninsula. Beyond camp, they climbed into the mountains, the bay stretching out beneath them, Michal and his sisters pointing at the lighthouse by Finnat, the outstretched arm of the Maharees and Kerry Head in the distance. Each of them taking turns to lie, say they could see the white flare of their house. High in the mountains, a valley now below them, a patchwork of fields speckling of houses and woodland, his mother indicated, took a narrow green-spined road down into the valley. This was Glaun na Galt, Valley of the Mad. His mother would tell them stories of the place, how for hundreds of years people, the sick, the sad, and those called mad, came or were brought down there to drink from a well within the valley. Its water was said to have restorative powers, would quell the turmoil within, bring peace for a time. Growing up, Michal was never sure whether to believe his mother. But some of the local history books he's been reading have confirmed that most of what she told them about the valley is true. One such book, The Ancient and Present State of the County of Kerry, written by a historian called Charles Smith in 1756, recounted the fable of the well, which drew, he said, all the mad folks of the kingdom seeking its healing effects. If it was so widely known in Smith's day, people must have been coming to the valley for a long time before that. Michal's mother saw a link between this place and theirs, how families in the valley, generations of them, helped the distressed visitors who pilgrimaged to that remote spot, led them to the well, took them in and cared for them, for weeks or even months in some cases. We are tied into the same tradition, she said, though Michal wondered if their land was in fact a counterpoint to the valley, the black spot to its white. Once parked near the entrance, Michal's mother made each child carry two plastic bottles to the well. Michal and Anya, like their mother, lugged the 5-litre plastic-handled Ballygowan bottles. Saoirse was given 2-litre bottles to carry under her arms. A wooden sign had been placed in the roadside ditch, Tobr na Nollt, Well of the Mad. After an opening in the ditch, they walked through undergrowth to what was, in reality, not so much a well as a spring, from which a small stream flowed. What Michal remembers most are the offerings that hung from branches above the stream, and along the spring. Bracelets, rosaries, strips of clothing, little ornaments poked out from among the watercress. An uneasiness always gripped him when there. He would fill the bottles in a rush, eager to get away. His mother often offered the visitors this water, said it would help. Told them the story of the valley. Some accepted, others declined. Michal sometimes saw her sneak it into their drinks anyway. He wonders if she did this to him and his sisters. He wouldn't put it past her. She drank a shot glass of it every morning with her breakfast. Michal found an article about the valley online last year. It included the details of a scientific testing of the spring water. And it turns out that they did find something of note. The water contained significantly higher than usual traces of lithium. The scientist quoted in the article was skeptical as to whether this raised amount would have any therapeutic value, though he didn't entirely discount it, and neither could he rule out that the levels of lithium may have been higher in decades and centuries past. He concluded by saying that maybe it was something about the place, the belief people had in it. That's what brought all those people such solace.
You've been listening to the wonderful Noel O'Regan reading from his debut novel, Though the Bodies Fall, which is out now with Granta Books.